And that brings us to the final chapter of the unit and of the course. And this one focuses on genetics at the chromosomal level. Earlier we were looking at genetics more at a molecular level, the level of the gene. And when we did all that discussion, since we were restricting our attention to a gene at a time, as we should, in essence, we were kind of pretending as though genes move around and act in isolation, as though they are their own particles. Remember that they're not, though, right? Any given gene is just a subset of the big long sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's that make up the entire chromosome. And there are thousands of genes on a single chromosome. When you're paying attention to just one, that's fine. But in reality, there's those thousands of others that are on that same particle. The particle is the chromosome. And when we talk about things moving around in meiosis, it's not individual genes that do that, right? It's individual chromosomes. So genes are kind of like passengers on some craft, like a boat. You know, chromosomes like a ship. The ship goes one destination. Anything on it goes there too, as a group. Well, we'll look inside one at a cross that we've already looked at. We just weren't paying attention to chromosomes before. We've already discussed this exact cross, though. And what kind of cross is this? How would you categorize this cross that we're looking at? Yellow-seeded, round-seeded parent crossed with a green-seeded, wrinkled-seeded parent.
Dihybrid?
That's right. It's a dihybrid cross. Now, why? Why is it? What does that mean?
Two different traits of a characteristic being crossed with each other and seeing the results through the F point at two generations.
You don't really have to mention traits.
Okay.
The two doesn't indicate traits. The die meaning two doesn't indicate traits. It indicates characteristics.
Ah.
So remember what a monohybrid cross is. Mono, meaning one, means that you're focusing on one characteristic. And what does the hybrid part indicate? That the two parents differ in their traits for that characteristic. So if we had done a white-flowered pea plant crossed with another white-flowered pea plant, that wouldn't be a hybrid cross. It would be a cross. It just wouldn't be a hybrid cross. It was purple crossed with white, though. That's what made it hybrid. Well, this is a hybrid cross because the parents, notice, differ in their traits, but we're simultaneously paying attention to two different characteristics that don't necessarily have anything to do with each other, right? We're just choosing those as our two characteristics of interest. What are the characteristics here? Seed shape, seed color, exactly. And once again, because we've looked at this exact cross before, one of the parents is doubly homozygous dominant, so they're not only true breeding, but the one parent is dominant for both of the two characteristics. The dominant color is yellow, and the dominant texture is round. The other one is doubly homozygous recessive, so it has the recessive color, green, and the recessive texture, or shape, wrinkled. But the information we didn't see in the slide when we previously looked at this is what's happening at the chromosome level. So, notice we have some chromosomes drawn in here, but the fact that there are four chromosomes here in this diploid parent does not mean that pea plants have an N of two. Once again, we're ignoring things that we aren't interested in. Before, we were ignoring all other genes because we were focusing on two genes. Now we're looking at the chromosomes, but we still don't care about chromosomes that aren't at all involved. So we're paying attention to two characteristics, and therefore two genes. Genes though occur on chromosomes, and these ones happen to occur on different chromosomes. So the color gene, which is the Y gene, is on one chromosome. The texture gene, which is the R gene, is on a different chromosome. And I don't know what the N is for pea plants, but it's higher than two. We're just ignoring all those other chromosomes. What do the black dots represent using biological terminology? No, those are not. There aren't sister chromatids. They're actually shown here as unreplicated chromosomes. Notice that each chromosome is just one sausage. But what does the black dot on each chromosome represent? Yeah. No, there's no crossing over here that's happening. Exactly. Each black dot represents that gene's locus, which is the actual position on the particular chromosome that gene is at. But these are diploid adults, so that's why there are two of each of these two chromosome types. The one that carries the color gene, there's two of them, two homologs of that chromosome, because this is a diploid parent. And similarly for the other one. Right? So two chromosomes carrying the Y genes, along with thousands of other genes that we're just not paying attention to, and two chromosomes carrying the R gene, along with thousands of genes that we also don't care about. Okay, you can see by labeling the loci, the black dots, with letters, what the genotypes are, right? These are doubly homozygous individuals. So upper, upper Y, upper, upper R for the one parent, lower, lower Y, lower, lower R for the other parent. All right. Well, if these parents are going to be parents, of course, their gametes need to get together. Not necessarily the individuals, but their gametes. Which means you need to produce those gametes first. And how do diploid organisms produce gametes? Via meiosis, right, which is listed here. And the point here is that meiosis, as we've really discussed already when we looked at meiosis, randomly chooses one homolog or the other for each of the N chromosomes in the cell. We're only paying attention to two of those N, whatever N is. But if you have true breeding adults, the randomness doesn't really matter, right? You're going to choose one of these uppercase Y, or one of the chromosomes with an uppercase Y. You're going to choose one of the chromosomes with an uppercase R, which means a true breeding adult can make really only one kind of gamete if all you care about is these two characteristics. You're going to get an uppercase Y carrying chromosome. You're going to get an uppercase R carrying chromosome from that adult, and lowercasers for the others, for the other parent. Which explains, when you get these two gametes together in the process of fertilization to produce the zygotes that are the F1 generation, explains why they are all genetically identical with respect to these two traits, right? They all have exactly the same genotype. What's another way of describing them? By saying that they, other than saying they all have the same genotype. Specifically, how would you describe all of the members of the F1 with biological terminology? Exactly. They're all doubly heterozygous because we're paying attention to two characteristics. So they all have to be upper Y, lower Y, upper R, lower R. All right? And that's why they all have all of the F1s, that is, they all have the same phenotypes for color and shape. They're all genetically identical with respect to those two characteristics, genotypically. Because of dominance, they all have the dominant color, and they all have the dominant shape. So they're all like the doubly dominant parent. That's the only possible offspring in the F1, are parental types, and specifically parental types of the dominant parent, like the dominant parent. But now, if you make the F2, you're going to have to cross these. First, they have to grow up to produce their own gametes in order for them to be crossed, right? But since they are heterozygous, when they do create gametes via meiosis, the randomness of the choice of chromosomes matters because there's two different ones in each of these heterozygous, right? You can choose the upper Y chromosome or the lower Y chromosome. The gamete's going to get one or the other because the gamete has to be haploid. That's what meiosis does. Okay, so at this point, we have the two boxes, one on either side of the figure, displaying two laws. These are Mendelian laws, laws that Mendel himself came up with without knowing anything about genes or DNA, like I said. The law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. Well, what's new about this is that we're putting them in the form of laws, but we've really talked about both of this before. Segregation and independent assortment. Which happens first? Segregation refers to separation, right? That's what it means to segregate. It says the law of segregation says the two alleles for each gene, this is for a diploid organism, right? A diploid organism has two alleles for each gene, one on each of the two homologs that carry that gene. Those two alleles separate during gamete formation. Law of independent assortment is exactly what we've already described about independent assortment, right? It says that a tetrad, which is a pair of homologous chromosomes, assort or line up, they flip their coin independent of all the other tetrads in that same cell. So which of these two things happens first? Segregation or independent assortment? No.
Independent assortment.
Yes. Independent assortment happens first, right? What does assortment actually specifically refer to? What part of meiosis? Metaphase one. That's when there is the lining up, which is the assortment, right? So that's when they flip their coins to determine whether it's going to be red up and blue down or blue up and red down. And each of the other tetrads are flipping their own coin, which is why it's not all red up and all blue down or all blue up and all red down. It's on a tetrad by tetrad basis. So that happens first, the right box. At meiosis one, or metaphase one of meiosis. When does separation occur? Or segregation, which is separation. Anaphase one, exactly. But it continues, of course, right? It's not just that they're separating from each other in that same cell. They actually become parts of different cells because in addition to meiosis, you're having cytokinesis happen. So they end up, the two alleles that start up together on homologs within the parental cell end up in totally different cells that end up as gametes, haploid gametes. And the result of all this is if you have however many offspring are produced, you expect there to be a 9:3 to 3:1 ratio in the F2, if you cross the F1s to produce the F2, you get the familiar Mendelian dihybrid ratio of 9:3 to 3:1. Now, what are the two categories? The 9 and the 1 represent one category. What are the, what is that? What are how, why are the 9 and the 1 in the same category? That's not what puts them in the same category. What do you notice is true of both of these that's not true of the 3s here? Yeah.
Same trait as their
parents. As one parent or the other. Exactly. And therefore, that's one of the categories. They are the parental types. Yellow and round is like one parent. Green and wrinkled is like the other parent. So they are parental types. What are the 3s called? What's the other category, in other words? If offspring are not parental types, they are what? Well, they're children no matter what. They're offspring. Well, yes, it is true that they are non-parental, but we have a word for that other than non-parental.
Recombinant.
They're all F2s. They're recombinant types, exactly. You can have parental types or recombinant types, and they're called recombinant types because they combine traits of both parents rather than being just like one parent or just like the other parent. They're not like either parent. They're a little bit like both of them. So this, the first 3 here has the dominant color like one parent, but the green round one has the recessive color like one parent and the dominant shape like the other parent. This one has the dominant color, but the recessive shape. They are recombinant types. Okay, now to 2. These cartoon flies that you see up here are, more specifically, fruit flies from a genus called Drosophila. Notice how I'm carefully italicizing that since it's a genus name. Drosophila is a genus of flies that are used often in genetic research. Mainly because they're very good model organisms. A couple reasons are because they are so easy to maintain. They don't die very easily in the lab. They're easy to maintain at your house too. All you have to do is keep a peeled banana out for about a half hour, and you can have some fruit flies in your house. So that's one reason that they're used. But also, a generation for them is only about a week. You can go from P to F1 in 1 week, F2 in another week, and so on. So, unlike having to wait 15 years if you're breeding humans, it's you can get a lot of generations just within a year of work, which is sometimes important in genetic research. So all kinds of different studies use fruit flies, and a lot of their genetics is known for that reason. What we care about in this chapter is eye color, as you see here. These photographs are close-ups of the eyes. I've used the phrase wild type before in other lectures. I just want to remind you that wild type refers to the trait or phenotype that is seen in the plurality of individuals in a natural population. Plurality means that there's more of that trait than any other kind of trait. And that does not necessarily mean it's dominant genetically. It often is, but it doesn't have to be. Wild type simply is the most encountered trait, though, if you actually look at a real population in nature. And for eye color, the wild type is this reddish color that is on the left. Other types compared to the wild type are called mutant, because to get that other type requires a change to DNA, which it requires a mutation. So the white-eyed one, and that, these aren't the only two possibilities, but these are the two that we're focusing on. The wild type, though, is The white eye is not wild type. That's a mutant type that is also, in this case, recessive to the red. And that's the little background. Now, in 3, we're going to look at a cross that seems like it's no different from what we've been studying already. But it is importantly different. Notice we're crossing a red-eyed individual with a white-eyed individual in the P generation. But when you look at that P generation, just that one line, the P generation, what do you notice that is different from the P generations we looked at in other crosses? Yeah. I think you're saying the right thing. But what is different about this is that we're paying attention to sex of the individuals. We didn't do that before, right? If you think about the first one we looked at, the pea flower color, purple and white, was a monohybrid cross. We crossed a purple flower with a white flower, but we didn't say that one of them had to be male and one of them had to be female. You could do it either way. Plants have sex, right? I mean, there are two sexes of plants. So you could conduct that either way. You could have a male purple-flowered crossed with a female white-flowered, or the other way around. And it didn't matter at all which way you did it in that case. The results would have been exactly the same numerically as far as the ratios are concerned. The reason it didn't matter, that sex didn't matter, sex of the parents, is because that was an example of an autosomal gene that we were studying. The flower color gene was autosomal. What does that mean? What is an autosomal gene? Right. In other words, even more directly, an autosomal gene is simply a gene that is on an autosome. That's where its locus is, some autosome. But you're right that an autosome is any chromosome that is not a sex chromosome. So of the thousands of genes in any given organism, you can think about them in 2 broad categories. Most genes are autosomal because there's usually a lot more autosomes than sex chromosomes. Like in humans, there's 22 autosomes, right? Numbers 1 through 22, if you remember that karyotype, they were actually numbered 1 through 22. There's a 23rd type of chromosome, but it wasn't numbered 23 in that human karyotype. It was just labeled as X and Y because that one happened to be a male. But that 23rd type is the sex chromosome, which is not an autosome. Sex chromosomes are called sex chromosomes in species that have them, and they don't all, because they are involved in determining the sex of offspring. That's why they're called sex chromosomes. But that doesn't mean that every gene that they carry have anything to do with determining the sex. Okay, so there's genes on sex chromosomes just like there are genes on autosomes. But some of those genes, many of those genes, have nothing to do with determining sex. They just happen to be on a chromosome that determines the sex. Okay? Now, imagine that human karyotype picture that we looked at. Pairs 1 through 23, because that was a diploid karyotype, right? There were 2 number 1s, 2 number 2s, and so on. All of the 22 pairs of autosomes were truly homologous. By which I mean, not only were they the same size as each other, the 2 homologs, but they contained the same exact number of genes, which are the same types of genes. Not necessarily identical, because there are different alleles possible for each gene, right? But two truly homologous chromosomes have the same number and types of genes that might or might not differ in their alleles. The sex chromosomes are not like that, though, at least in humans and in fruit flies. And I don't know whether you can picture the karyotype, and I don't have it up to show you. But that was a human karyotype, and it was a male, so there was an X and a Y. They were not the same size. And so they are not truly homologous. The X and the Y chromosomes are considered to be homologous. They correspond to each other because they're both sex chromosomes, and they actually do synapse. But they are not truly homologous because they're not the same size, and they therefore don't carry the same number of chromosomes. The bigger chromosome, which in us and in fruit flies is the X chromosome, contains all the genes that the smaller Y chromosome contains, but also others that aren't found on the Y, because that part is just missing on the smaller chromosome. Okay? And this matters because that means the two sexes, the sex of which is determined by these chromosomes, are going to differ with respect to how many alleles they have for a gene that is on the sex chromosome, whose locus is on the sex chromosome. So there's not only, since there are two major categories of chromosomes, autosomes and sex chromosomes, correspondingly there are two major categories of genes, based on where they're found, based on the kinds of chromosomes they're found. There are autosomal genes, and there are sex-linked genes. So that hyphenated phrase, sex-linked, means simply that the gene, which we call sex-linked, has its locus, or is found, on a sex chromosome, as opposed to being found on an autosome. Okay? Well, as we'll talk about in a little bit, sex determination occurs different ways for different species. But humans and fruit flies happen to have the same basic system, which is called the XY system, where a genetic female is an XX and a genetic male is an XY, and Y is much smaller than X and therefore is missing a bunch of the genes that X has, including the one for eye color in fruit flies. All right? Keep that in mind as we look now at the similarities. This fools you into thinking this is no different from the purple flower, white flower example, but it is. We're crossing a red-eyed female with a white-eyed male. And when we look at the F1 generation, however many offspring there are, every one of them has red eyes, which is the dominant phenotype. So it seems exactly like the flower example, right? Every one of the F1s in the pea plant example had the dominant phenotype. So that's the Mendelian pattern. Complete dominance means it only takes one allele from that dominant parent to make all the offspring dominant in their trait. Then you cross the brothers and sisters in the F1 to produce the F2. And notice the results. Still seems like it's just like the pea plant example. Because 3/4 of the offspring are red-eyed, dominant, and 1/4 of them are recessive, white-eyed. The difference here is that in the pea plant example, when you got to the F2, yes, it's 75% purple flowered and 25% white flowered, but that 75% purple flower or dominant trait is made up of roughly 50% males and 50% females. just like the 25% recessive, white-flowered individuals are. It's males and females both. That's not what's happening here, though. Notice the symbols. This is the female symbol. This is the male symbol. So in the F2, yes, overall, there were 3/4 of them were red-eyed and 1/4 were white-eyed, but 100% of the females were red-eyed. Half of the males were red-eyed, and half were white-eyed. So the only white-eyed individuals were male. Okay? Now let's look at this again, starting over at the P generation, but now paying attention to chromosomes. And these chromosomes are X and Y chromosomes, sex chromosomes. So that's why I said that this one gene that we're looking at, the eye color gene in fruit flies, is an example of a sex-linked gene because it occurs on a sex chromosome. Doesn't mean eye color has anything to do with sex determination. It's just where it is. It's where its locus is. For an autosomal gene, both males and females have two alleles for that gene, right? Because an autosomal gene is truly homologous, the pairs. And therefore, a diploid individual is going to have two alleles no matter which gene on that chromosome you're talking about. And that's why for an autosomal gene, we can safely use one of those three phrases we talked about to describe the genotype. What are the three phrases?
Homozygous dominant.
Homozygous recessive. And heterozygous, yes. All three of those phrases use words that require there to be two alleles in the individual, right? In other words, they're diploid, they have two alleles. Homozygous means that both of the alleles, so two, it's talking about two, are the same. Heterozygous means that the two alleles are different. You have to have two for that as well. Well, we don't use that word when referring to a male if the gene we're interested in is sex-linked, for an XY system at least, like humans and fruit flies. And that's because this eye color gene is on the X chromosome, but it's not on the Y chromosome because the Y chromosome doesn't have that part of the chromosome. It's not as big as the X. So that means a female will have two eye color alleles, just like in the autosomal case. But a male will have only one. Wouldn't make sense to call a male homozygous or heterozygous, right? Because both of those words point to having two alleles. Instead, for a sex-linked gene in the XY system, we call a male hemizygous. What does hemi mean? It means the same as demi, and it means the same as semi.
Half.
Half, yeah. This refers to the fact that a male compared to a female has half as many alleles. He has one, she has two. Now, dominance exists here, I said. Red is dominant over white, but a hemizygous male has only one allele. So whatever it is, that's the trait that male's going to have, right? Dominance recessivity really only comes into play if you have two. You can't have domination of one over the other if you only have one. All right, let's look at these chromosomes. This is the P generation again, but shown with the chromosomes. This is a true breeding red-eyed female or wild-type female. Once again, they're making a brand new set of standards here. We usually used a letter like P for purple to indicate the dominant trait. Well, here we're using the letter for the recessive trait, W for white. But if it has a superscript plus, that means instead of being the actual recessive one, it's the wild type one, which is red. So W plus means red. W by itself means white. Okay? But anyway, she's true breeding red-eyed, so both of her X's have a W+, a red allele. And she is a female because her both of her sex chromosomes are the X version. She's an XX. That makes her a female. Okay? He's a male, so he has to be XY chromosomally. And since this is a sex-linked gene that we're looking at, it's on the X chromosome but not on the Y chromosome. That's why he's a hemizygote. And he happens to have the recessive allele. It's the only allele he has. So that makes him white-eyed. All right. Well, when we make the F1 generation, we can represent that with a Punnett square. This true-breeding female can make only one kind of egg in both respects that we care about here. I say both respects. We're paying attention to one characteristic, but we're also paying attention to sex chromosomes. So the allele is going to, the alleles, if there are more than one, are going to determine eye color, but the chromosome types are going to determine the sex of the offspring as well. Okay? Anyway, females make eggs, and she's true breeding. You're going to randomly choose an X. So as far as sex chromosomes are concerned, she can make only one kind of egg. It's going to have an X chromosome no matter what. And since she's true breeding, it's going to have a W+, or red allele on it. That's why there's only one row in this Punnett square. You could do it as two rows, but it would just be copying it over. This is the only choice from this female. A male, though, can make two kinds of sperm for two reasons. He's a male, so he's XY, therefore his sperm can have an X, or his sperm can have a Y. And, of course, the Y isn't caring anything about what eye color. So when you form this Punnett square and get the gametes together, sperm with egg, to produce the zygotes, as usual, since these are sex chromosomes that the gene is being carried on, we not only get information for the zygotes about the gene we're looking at, the characteristic, eye color, we're also getting information about the sex of the offspring. And when an X-carrying sperm gets together with the X-carrying egg, that's going to make an XX individual. That's why this half of the Punnett square represents all the females. And they're all going to be heterozygous females. Right? Because the X, one of the X's in the XX offspring, has to come from the father. The only X that he can pass is one with a white allele. So they're all going to be heterozygous, but because of dominance, they're all going to be red-eyed. I'm sorry, this is the one for F1. The males that are produced are all going to be hemizygous, because they're males, but a male can only get his X chromosome from his mother, right? He has to get the Y from the only sex that has a Y, his father. So this X has to be red coming from the mother. And once again, that's why all of the males are red-eyed. So all of the offspring in the F1 are red-eyed, but for a different reason compared to them all being purple-flowered in the autosomal case. Is this all making sense? Okay, and then let's make the F2 by crossing these two F1s. Well, all the females are heterozygous, which means they can produce two different kinds of eggs. Every egg is going to have to carry an X, but there's two kinds of X's in this F1 female. So she can give an egg with a red trait or an egg with an X with a white trait. White allele. He can give an X or a Y sperm. And when you get those together, this explains the F2. 100% of the females are red-eyed because of dominance. But half of those females are homozygous, and that's why there's two listings for females here, even though they look the same. Half of them are homozygous dominant, half of them are heterozygous. That's this box. When it comes to males, half of them will be red-eyed because they got the X, the red version of the X from their mother. The other half will be white-eyed because they got the white-eyed X from their mother. And they got the Y from their father, which isn't doing anything for eye color, but it's making it male. That's these two pictures. That's a sex-linked sex-linked gene. Well, 4 is just a photograph of real X and Y chromosomes. This is from a human, though, actually, instead of a fruit fly. But it does show you, just like the karyotype showed you that we looked at earlier, that there is a drastic size difference. These are considered to be homologous, but they're not truly homologous because on these ends of the chromosome on the X, there just isn't a corresponding part on the Y. So all the genes contained in this area are on X only, but not also in Y. All the genes that are on Y are also on X. And though, even though we do still call those sex-linked genes because they are on a sex chromosome, they will operate, the ones that are on both X and Y, will operate just the same way as autosomal genes would because both sexes have two alleles. Well, now we can go to 5 and talk about sex determination mechanisms. But this is just a short list. This is not at all an exhaustive list of the ways in which sex can be determined in sexual species. For one thing, all we're looking at here is just a small sample of animals. But animals are just one kind of sexual organisms, right? Plants are sexual. Fungi are sexual. Many protists are sexual. So this is a small sample, but it shows you that there can be quite a bit of difference in how species determine the sex of the offspring. We'll start with humans because we're familiar with them being them. As we've been discussing, we use the XY system. So when you look at a human, this male here on the top has a genotype represented as 44 plus XY. What does that mean?
22 autosomal, 22 autosomal, and the sex chromosome.
Right, but if you have 22, why does it say 44? Yeah. Were you raising your fingernail? Why is it 44? If you just you correctly said that there's 22 autosomes, or 22 types of autosomes. No. How many different versions of sex chromosomes?
Diploid.
Right, it's diploid. This is a diploid human male. So 22 times 2 is 44. Those are the autosomes, plus one pair of sex chromosomes, in this case an X and a Y, for a total of 46. 46 overall chromosomes is 2N for humans, because N for humans is 23. 22 autosomes and a sex chromosome. Female is also 44, but she's plus XX, because both of her sex chromosomes are X, which makes her genetically a female. Well, this is Y in humans and other XY species. This is Y, the male, the father, determines the sex of the offspring. Gamete formation has to occur in each parent before they fertilize. But there's only one kind of egg, chromosomally, that a female can make. Doesn't matter which X you choose, you're going to pass an X off to the offspring. The father, though, can pass an X sperm or a Y sperm. And depending on which of those sperm is selected, the offspring is either XX, X from the father and X from the mother, or XY, X from the mother and Y from the father. The father determines the offspring's sex in XY. All right? Below that is grasshoppers, which represent the X0 system, although most people say XO. Notice that it actually is a zero, though, not a letter. 0 indicating that it's just not there at all. So 22 plus XX is a female grasshopper. What is the N for that species?
11.
No. Eleven is the number of autosomes.
Oh.
What is N?
12.
There's 11 autosomes and a sex chromosome. All right? But notice that for males, they are 22 plus X, just one X. So in the X0 system, there is no other kind of sex chromosome. All you have is X chromosomes. But if you have two of them, that makes you a female. And if you have just one of them, that makes you a male. So a little bit different from what we're using. Most birds use the ZW system, as you already learned in lab, right? When you did your owl experiments, that those are birds. ZW system is almost identical to the XY system other than the names of the chromosomes. The big difference, though, is in which sex is the one with two different kinds of chromosomes and therefore the one that determines the sex of the offspring. So unlike humans, in which two X's make a female, two of the same kind, a male has two Z's. What is the N here for this species? Right. 76 is the 38 autosomes, plus you have a sex chromosome, which is either Z or W. Two Z's make the bird a male. A Z and a W make the bird a female. And therefore, in birds, it's the mother that determines the sex of the offspring, because she can make an egg that carries a Z or an egg that carries a W to get together with the only kind of sperm that the father can make, which is a Z-carrying sperm. All right, the bottom one is, from our point of view, the weirdest one. Perfectly normal for bees, but it's weird for us to think about. That's the so-called haplodiploid system, where, or in which, there are only autosomes. There are two sexes, as you would expect in a sexual species, but there are only autosomes. There are no sex chromosomes. And what matters, therefore, is the ploidy to determine the sex. There are, in this species, an N of 16. There are 16 autosome types. If you have two of each of those, in other words, if you are diploid as a bee, that makes you a female. If you have only one of each of those 16, in other words, if you're haploid, then you are a male bee. Okay, so that's pretty different from our system already. But what really is quite different is that, unlike the vast majority of sexual species that require two parents to be involved in sexual reproduction, or just in successful reproduction, which is sexual, not true for bees. Females lay eggs, just like females and humans do. But unlike in humans, in which an egg that fails to be fertilized is simply going to die as an egg not long after it's created. Right? It's a haploid human that doesn't live very long and just doesn't become diploid and turn into a diploid human. But in bees, a female bee, which by definition is a diploid individual, she will make eggs the same way as a diploid human or other animal would, by undergoing meiosis, which reduces the ploidy, right? So when she lays eggs, they are haploid eggs. But she doesn't have to have her eggs be fertilized. She doesn't have to mate with a male bee in order for those eggs to actually develop into adults. They don't just die as eggs if they're unfertilized. But if, since they are haploid eggs, if there no sperm is involved, if they don't get fertilized, the ploidy will remain haploid, and they'll just become multicellular. And they become males. What this means is a female can choose not to mate and produce nothing but sons on her own. Yeah.
So if the female does choose to mate, it would result in a diploid.
That's right. If she does choose to mate, then every one of those offspring produced by a successful fertilization of an egg with a sperm from who she mates with is going to be a daughter, because it's going to be diploid. She can mate to make daughters. She cannot mate to make sons, which is quite different from how we do things. And it has some interesting ramifications. A male bee has no father. Right? Because if it had a father, then the offspring would be diploid, which would make it him a female, not a male. Similarly, a male bee cannot have a son. Because if he does mate, then he's going to create a diploid offspring, which has to be a female. So he can have only daughters. But even though he doesn't have a father and he can't have sons, he does have a grandfather and he can have grandsons. He has a grandfather because his mother, which produced him on her own, is diploid. That's why she's a female. So she had to have two parents, right? One of which would be his grandfather. And a male bee can have a grandson, because if he mates, he's going to produce daughters, each of which can just individually by themselves lay unfertilized eggs that become males, which would be his grandsons. Does that all make sense? It makes sense to bees.
You say it's a little weird to us.
It is weird from our point of view, but without sex chromosomes, you're playing with the ploidy, and that makes things quite a bit different. Yeah, go ahead.
So meiosis II is impossible for bees, or how hard is that?
No, meiosis II still happens. There's just no sex chromosomes. Yeah, both sexes make. Oh, you mean in males? In males, they don't undergo meiosis because they're already haploid.
I mean, like.
But the female undergoes normal meiosis because she's diploid, and she has to make haploid eggs from her diploid cells, just like for humans.
Okay, so then like when they have the kid, right?
Yeah.
Because you have to undergo meiosis one and meiosis two. Meiosis two makes it into. Like a haploid cell?
No, meiosis 1 makes it haploid. Meiosis 2 simply gets rid of the extra chromatid. The ploidy doesn't change in meiosis 2, just like it doesn't change in mitosis, which meiosis 2 is pretty much like. But she is diploid, and therefore she has to undergo meiosis to cut the ploidy in half to make haploid eggs. The father is already haploid, so it doesn't make sense for him to undergo meiosis. He makes his gametes by mitosis, just making extra cells from the haploid ones that are already in his body.
So the father undergoes mitosis to then give?
To make sperm. Once you have the sperm and the egg, they're the same way as in any species. If they get together, that's going to make a diploid offspring, though, which, because it's diploid, is going to have to be a female, a daughter.
So how does it like, cut the ploidy to make like males?
By not mating. She makes the haploid gamete, the egg, and just doesn't mate. So unlike us, the egg doesn't just die as an unfertilized egg. It undergoes mitosis to become a multicellular haploid, and therefore male bee, a son. All right, I think I'll stop there and give you a couple more minutes to prepare for the practicum. I can finish this up next time.